what's your day been like so far, or what's been on your mind lately? Those kinds of things. It's just a different. It's like the alternative to in like quasi like networking situation of like, what do you do? Or even like at a wedding or something like that, you know, where like it's just like one of,
do you find like, I've started recording because I think instantly this is going to be interesting, by the way.
Just, yeah, I see the red light. I see the red light is on.
Yeah. Like that whole, what do you do, is like one of the hardest questions in the free world to answer for anyone, especially if you work in some form of cycling side of the world.
Yeah, well, I think some people really, you and I probably can think of quite a few examples, some people really identify what they do with who they are, and it kind of like is emblematic or defines who they are, which has pros and cons. So some people really embrace that, and other people, their job certainly doesn't define who they are or something. So yeah, it's difficult. Like even other questions like, where are you from, is an interesting one, because some people could say like a country or a town. But I think in the circles that you and I run in, people often live somewhere that they're not originally from, or they live somewhere else. And it just sparks like this whole other conversation of all these other kind of places and reasons of why they, you know, have some complicated answer to it, which typically I would say people are often pretty keen to share. But yeah, it's just kind of a funny thing to keep in mind, like the icebreaker stuff.
Yeah, that whole how are you at the moment, it's so weird, isn't it? Like, I don't know, I've been quite like positive about everything going on. But I think, do you know what I think it is? I think this last week has been tough because the weather in the UK has just like monumentally shifted. And I sit when I'm at home at my desk like I am right now, I sit and I have a massive window in front of me that looks out across London, and when it's hammering it down, I'm just like, oh fucking hell.
And then,
it's like right now it's sunny, but like half an hour ago it was monumental rain.
Yeah, it was raining today also. It's funny you mentioned this example, because I sit in the kitchen typically in our house, because I haven't really been in the office since sometime in like mid March ish or so. And my back is facing the window, and I close the curtain, and I'm like facing like there's actually three doors that come to the kitchen. But like, because it typically has been sunny, uncharacteristic, I guess London and Amsterdam have a lot in common weather wise. Today it was raining, which was fine, but now it is sunny. But it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind also, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
I'm inside because I have to be. Though I have been riding bigger rides. So I haven't been riding a lot. It's not like I'm riding every day. I have some rollers. I actually have a kicker. I haven't been Zwifting this whole time. But because the Netherlands, compared to what I understand, has been the general rule in England, where you can go outside for an hour at a time. Here, because cycling is kind of always going to be supreme, you can ride as much as you like. And I've been looking for new roads. I've revisited places that I've been before, like certain regions or corners of the country. But there's a tool called wanderer.earth. It's a friend of mine named Craig in Atlanta, where I am from, in many respects of where being from means. And it syncs with your Strava. And it shows the roads that you've never ridden, per your Strava record. And then I use Komoot to find highlights along the way. So I've been doing massive, like 200 and 250 kilometer rides on to places I've never been before, as opposed to cycling indoors, which I know a lot of people have had to do. So I'm fortunate that I can bust a move like that. And that's made a difference too.
Yeah, I reckon I'm going to complete Zwift soon. I'm not far off, I don't think.
Like you versus the final boss.
I'm level 42. I'm level 42. There's probably much more to go.
They should have like a Zwift story mode. I think that would be pretty good. You know, like Final Fantasy Zwift or something like that.
I mean, so I've used it since 2016. I was looking back on my billing the other day, And 2016 was when I started using Zwift, which is, and to see how much it's like progressed in 4 years is crazy. And now there's like, there's a lot of other programs out there. You know, you've got Road Grand Tour.
True. Ruby.
There's loads of B Corps, I think, are doing it. Like, there's quite a lot of competition for it. But they really were kind of the first to do that.
I agree. And I know this personally because when I started Two Tone, which originally was kind of just like a freelance means of survival here in Amsterdam, I subcontracted through another agency that's been around for 10 years or more, I think, True Communications. You maybe have had some contact with through the work that you do in California. And they had Zwift as a client way back in 2014. So I helped organize and what's the word? Like enact the Zwift launch with Jens Vogt and I'm trying to remember what other pros were there. I think it was at Bespoked, the shop. Cool. I think you guys know those guys. And that was in December of 2014. And people couldn't be bothered, man. It's like you needed a smart trainer, ideally. People were like, what? And then you need like an Ant Plus dongle. They were like, what did you say? And like everyone kind of hated training indoors because they were just like staring at a wall. And I'm like, this could be way more fun. And getting people to even try it, that's like going on 5+ years ago now.
It's nuts, isn't it?
It's crazy. And now see how far they've come. It's totally true. It's impressive. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great. Like in the UK, we can ride outside, but we are. Yeah. I mean, I think it's frowned upon to go out for long rides. There's nothing has officially been said. It has been officially said in Wales, but not in Britain.
Maybe I misunderstood. I read something someone sent me said they could only go out for an hour at a time. Maybe they were in Wales. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Wales is definitely like that. And Ireland as well is quite similar. And you have to stay within a certain proximity to your house. But in Britain, it's kind of... You can, but I think it's frowned upon. And like my attitude's been very much on the sense of like, I'm acting as if I have COVID-19. Like, I'm keeping my outside time, you know, well, not fully acting as if I have it. As in, like, I'm not going nowhere. Like, but I'm reducing my exposure to the outside world as much as I can. Because I don't know, I just feel like it's the right thing to do. And until... we're in a bit more of a stable situation here. If I lived a bit more in the countryside, I'd probably be thinking quite different. But living in central, like I'm in Shoreditch, it's just like, I literally can't walk out of my flat without seeing someone.
Yeah, it's a obviously like a pretty sprawling topic, like the whole corona thing. But one of the things I read recently is that population density doesn't necessarily like, imply per se that like the virus would spread more quickly, but then like you would assume, of course, but then it also hinges upon how people in the populace behave, how stringent the government can be, and each country has adopted a different way of establishing like guidelines, enforcing guidelines. Each country has like a different way that like socially people accept or reject what's being said. And it's been a pretty crazy thing to watch. Cause I think what I typically say to people, even before any of this kind of madness went down for here in the Netherlands, if they block a street with like a barrier, because there's construction or there's something, even like some kind of film crew, or they're unloading or loading something for some kind of, I don't know what, it can be just like some big delivery or who knows.
Yeah.
The first or second cyclist rolls up, they move the barrier just enough for them and they roll through, and then immediately a sea of people follow them. And it's amazing to watch. And it happens every time. One of these big rides I did recently, I was rolling down the street, like heading east out of the city, and rolled up on this construction site. And the first thought in my mind is like, sweet, some gravel in the middle of the city, which is kind of like what I always think. I'm like, can I ride this? So I just kind of send it straight through the the construction site without thinking of any kind of like statement that I'm making. But then I noticed that my saddle was a little bit lower. This was the Lester that, you know, this bike, I had it in Morocco.
Yeah.
And I know because
Kyrgyzstan, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I had just reassembled it finally, like since I wasn't. Yeah, it's crazy. I've been riding like every one of my bikes. There's like one or two that I haven't ridden, but I've been like revisiting bikes on these rides too that have just been hanging up. And I noticed my saddle was low and I stopped to like raise it a little bit before I really got rolling. And I noticed a bunch of other people that didn't care if it was really gravel or not rolling behind me through this construction thing, which officially was blocked. So people here, it's a mixed bag. Like if I go grocery shopping, no one is wearing a mask. No one, not the employees, none of the people at the counter, none of the people working for the grocery store, and almost entirely no one shopping. But then this big national holiday, King's Day, here in the Netherlands, which usually is just bananas, and everyone was told to stay home, largely people did. They were kind of on their porch, but the streets weren't packed. There wasn't any kind of crazy stuff going on. And by and large, people played along. So it's all kind of relative, but country by country, it's been totally different, you know?
It's quite fascinating as well. Like, as I was thinking about it the other day, that like, it's never been in, obviously, like in my lifetime, in your lifetime, we've never really had a situation like this. So it's as a kind of fucked up social experiment, it's quite interesting seeing how different governments are kind of dealing with it. Like, I'm finding it fascinating, to be honest, in a really fucked up way, because it's just like, shit, this is, you know, there's not a correct answer on what the best solution is yet. There just isn't.
No, I think like the biggest thing that like if I were to talk to like my kids or my girlfriend's kids or colleagues or, you know, even in a conversation like this, typically, and us both being, you know, officially millennials, I was born in 84, which is like right at the cusp. It's like I over we, it's like hashtag self-care all the time. And everybody's like focused on productivity and like what they can do, and like it's just, you know, it's just the classic criticism of like this generation is like how selfish it can be. And obviously this affects everyone of every age, particularly older people are more susceptible, but those are the people, particularly here in Europe, that remember what it's like to put we over me, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So
that's where again these stereotypes of like country by country, where is the collective good more valued over like your personal liberty or preference or something? And myself being from the United States, it's definitely a mixed bag over there, but the trend has been that like every single person is an expert and they know best for themselves, and like everyone else can just forget about it. And yeah, that's when you start to see some problems, and then that has all kinds of other implications. So I know this isn't like a political podcast.
They keep getting quite political, and I like that. I think it's quite funny.
But I think that's good. I think that's good too. And I only say that because I want to stay on topic, or if you have an agenda for us. But on that note, I certainly don't think that it's taboo to dive into that stuff. I think people in the States are hesitant. But when I first came to Europe as an exchange student when I was 17, and that's when Bush Jr. was like bombing Iraq and all those kinds of things around like his presidency that was so, people around the world were so critical of, I had to answer for that. And I was like 17 and 18 years old, and I wasn't used to having to have a political opinion then. And I think people in Europe are more used to that, but I think you should be able to debate stuff and bring it up and it not be some taboo thing, of course.
Yeah. I mean, my tactic with our chat today was just to kind of, this is going to be episode 15 of the podcast, which is about...
Damn, going out.
Yeah, I know. It's fucking nuts, isn't it? going to put it out at some point next week. I try and do them on like Wednesdays and Saturdays, but I've had like two really, really, really busy, stressful weeks of work that I've kind of slipped. And I kind of just wanted to talk to you because you're an interesting person. Like,
thank you.
we first met in Kyrgyzstan, 2018.
Yep.
That's right, isn't it? And that was the first edition of the the Silk Road Mountain race. We then met again this year. We haven't really met a lot of times, but I feel like we've talked a lot. We met again this year at the Atlas Mountain race. Same thing, first edition of that race. Met at really random points during the race.
Yep.
I remember going walking through that like dried up like fucking dump with you.
Oh, up the like trash ravine thing.
Yeah, it's just as stunk as shit. Absolutely. Yeah. Disgusting. And I've always found you a very interesting person, which is part of the reason why I wanted to do this. And
thank you, man.
All the podcasts of all the idea of all of them is that they generally are very informal chats with people, just about anything and everything.
That's cool. Yeah, I saw you just interviewed Greg Thorne, who used to live here in Amsterdam, who I've stayed in touch with.
Yeah.
Also super super funny guy. Last time I rode with him here, he was in town, also with Lachlan Morton. And Greg was like messing around, and he was doing like a quote unquote gravel ride on a road bike, and slammed somehow. I don't know what he was doing. Like went over the bars, no gloves. Maybe he had a glove. Ripped his hand open. And people were making fun of me earlier because I had this big rando bag that you know from Silk Road and Atlas on my Lester. And yeah. They're like, man, what do you have in there? I'm like, dude, and I have all kinds of stuff in there, extra jackets, food, like just random shit, but also a first aid kit. And on the spot, I have some pretty gruesome videos of it. We were able to bandage his hand, but then when we stopped for food later because it rained the whole time, he was able to like cut off the skin with the scissors that are in there and re-bandage it later also. So that's my most recent Gregory Thorne story. And he was in good spirits about it all, cracking jokes the whole time. But having a first aid kit was handy for sure.
Finally, I really enjoyed the chat with him, Mark. I've never properly spoken to him. There's so many weird like connections and coincidences in both of our lives, which I found brilliant. Like both, but like the first one was like we both used to play rugby at a pretty high level. Both retired from rugby because of horrific injuries. Then started cycling, which is quite funny. But it's weird to think now that Atlas Mountains is how long ago is that now? We went in March, didn't we?
No, it was August. Of 2018.
Oh, Silk Road was August 2018. Yeah, Atlas was this year.
Yeah, sorry, you said Atlas. Yeah, so we were there in February.
Yeah.
In the middle of February because Christy, my girlfriend, and I, for Valentine's Day, but also just because we were there, she volunteered with the organization. I know you got to hang out with her a little bit. Also, while you were in Morocco, beforehand, pardon me?
She got me drunk.
Well, I've heard like funny stories and you guys were like in like the transfer car with all the bikes from people that, had pulled out of the race, which was quite like dicey or something, but we stayed, I'm trying to remember the name of the word for it. It's like, the like fancy kind of like hotel kind of things they have there. What are they called?
Oh, I can't think what they're called even now. I know what you mean.
Riyadh. Like everybody was staying at some Riyadh, and it legitimately super super nice. And I'm still in contact with one of the guys that worked at the Riyadh that was also into cycling, which was super cool, which is perfectly applicable for this conversation. So like now I have like some bike homie in Marrakesh. But my point is it was Valentine's Day. So we had like some romantic Valentine's Day getaway before Atlas, you know?
Yeah. Valentine's Day was the Thursday, wasn't it? I think. And
right before the race started. Yeah.
Yeah. It's before the race started, wasn't it? Cause like, yeah, I came out and, it was just, I remember Christy was saying about like, you had like rose petals or something.
Oh, well that was the dude. His name was Aziz. And he knew, like, I don't think for some reason there weren't that many people staying there. And we requested dinner, and he set up like rose petals everywhere with like candles in front of this like fireplace. And like, we had the dinner, which was really good. I was like, sweet, now I have to build my bike because I hadn't even built my bike yet. So I built the Lester like by fireside surrounded by rose petals. It was amazing.
I mean, that's pretty awesome as a way to say you're building up your bike, isn't it?
For sure.
But that whole, how did you think Atlas Mountains was compared to Silk Road?
It's difficult to compare, but I think for people that were there or people that are interested in this kind of thing, clearly if you look at either one of them, Silk Road is like that much longer. I think it's like 700 something or more like kilometers or so longer, which is like a pretty considerable distance. The terrain varied much more. The altitudes were higher in Kyrgyzstan. You went longer without seeing civilization, I feel like, in Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
What was deceiving about Atlas is because you thought it was shorter. I think a lot of people thought they could just like smash it, like they could just do it. And even the people that had done Silk Road and kind of knew what they were getting into, myself included, I was like, okay, let me bring a few contingency plans and like understand what I did wrong last time and just do this. But then I think the realization a lot of people had, probably yourself as well, is like, damn, like we have to go really far every day. Within the first few days of like running into people, the conversation was, yeah, on average, I think you had to do like 150 or more kilometers a day to finish on time. And I don't think people, it is straight math, so that shouldn't have been a surprise. But I think wrapping your head around how difficult that was to accomplish, you know, I was riding well past midnight, having started at something like, you know, 5, 6, let's say the latest 7, but definitely around 6 a.m. each day. So from 6 a.m. until midnight every day. So, you know, I was laying down for like 4 or 5 hours at all, you know, and not really stopping much throughout each day. And the other thing, and I can't stop myself, it was the same in Silk Road, because I was riding with Max and Justin, Max from Podia, and I just have fun with this stuff. I'm never super competitive. I've been competitive in road racing, certainly on the velodrome for track racing. I've raced cross and all. I used to do alley cats, all that kind of stuff. So I like to win. I like to try to win. But nowadays, like, I'm just having fun. I think you know this from riding with me. Like, I'm like shooting funny videos, cracking jokes. I like to jam sometimes, and I'm still competitive. But like, I don't really care about KOMs anymore. And in this case, you know, I was just having fun. So I was balancing kind of cruising and making sure that I was staying on target to finish. So yeah. I like to think that I was mid pack, but I might have been like back of mid pack, I think.
Yeah. I think that, I was pretty gutted to have to have pulled out, but it was, I've spoken about it a bit with Stefano, and like my take on it was like, I slipped a disc pretty bad in December, and I was advised not to do the race. And I felt like I was feeling all right. So I thought, fuck it, I'll go out. I booked it all, it's fine. And I went out, and I think my fault was I did not quite expect the surface to be quite as rough as it was. It was rougher than I thought it was going to be.
It's a good point to bring up for sure. That the classic, like the Colonial Road one, like it just it pummeled you, man. And you didn't really have that in Kyrgyzstan. Like most of it was rideable.
Yeah, and like it proper like shook you up, and then like the widest tires I could fit on my bike was 38s, I think.
Screwed.
Yeah, exactly. You need 650s and like 47s on there, really, to be honest.
Well, at least I had 45 on the front and 2.1 on the back, which is like 55. And yeah. I wish I would have had bigger on the front for sure. Yeah,
we're
on
the same page. And I mean the Lauf forks helped a bit, but not enough. And then I crashed, and that's when I jarred my back out again. And it's only been the last 2 weeks where I've actually started to feel good again with my back. So it was definitely the right decision to have stopped when I did, because I was at a point where I was struggling to stand up properly. So. And that's when your lovely partner decided to get me hammered on red wine.
Amazing. Which everyone understood, like, booze would be hard to come by out there, but that wasn't the case. So that was fine.
Yeah, it seemed to be quite easy on that day anyway.
Yeah, so keep that in mind for future Atlas participants. You can find as much alcohol as you want out there.
Yeah. Now, would you go back and do either of them again?
This is a classic, like, response from me. I don't know what motivated it initially. I think for the nature of the kind of work that I do and kind of my background, or just at this point now, it's become kind of a tradition. I love to be at the first edition of things. And on one hand, it's kind of like a hipster, like the band before they, you know, were big kind of mentality. But, you know, I was at the first Torino Nice rally, one of the first, like, Dalsan Runts in Sweden before that got really big. You and I both were at Silk Road with Atlas. Some of them don't quite count. It was kind of like when they became kind of like more on the map. I did Dirty Boar in Belgium a few years ago, or like the Aggregate 100 up in near Leeds in the UK. There's a bunch of random events and also more well-known events. If they come on my radar and I know it's the first time, I'm super stoked to do it. Like, I wanted to do Trans-Pyrenees. Yeah. And frankly, I just kind of like screwed up with the application process and then kind of just missed the boat. And it already was like super crazy schedule for me around the time of year. Yeah. So I wasn't able to swing it. Further is another one, which I did, was at the first edition of, which we got a ton of buzz like all over also. So yeah, that's like conducive for my work when people talk about gravel or bike packing or like certain products or people in the industry or quote unquote influencers, any of that kind of stuff. Like, I'm rubbing elbows with those people and I'm actually out there also doing it. So to answer your question, it's often tough for me to ever justify or even have the motivation to do the second or third or fourth edition of a race because I've already kind of done it, even though I know it's different. And then that same year, there's always new events that I'm tempted by. And I think the only exception that I could make, and people always ask me, is if I've done TCR, and I always saw it from a distance, but never could allocate the time or justify it or whatever, because it's a 2-week investment. You're doing 300K a day for 2 weeks, which I would love to do. And I know this year, of course, is canceled, but the 10-year edition is coming up in the next 2 years or something. I think this year would have been the 8th year of TCR.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's 8th.
So it's 8th. Maybe I would do like the 10th year anniversary of TCR. I've thought about that, especially because on this topic, when you're talking about like slip discs and crashing and like your tires are too small. And like, I've done these races. Atlas was mostly fine. I voiced my utter contempt for that extended sand section at the end that you didn't have the pleasure of experiencing. But I was like, what is this? I even like apologized to Nelson then. I'm like, sorry, I was so rude on the internet, but Jesus. And then Further, I love Camille. He's super wild. But like so much of Further was just like bananas. It was just, I was just carrying my bike also in places that I shouldn't have really done, because you were able to choose the routes from required section to required section. So some of it was kind of my fault too. But with TCR, you're just jamming from, you know, supermarket to supermarket across the whole continent, and you can actually ride your bike. So I thought of these like bike packing races recently. Sometimes I'm just like, man, I just want to ride my bike. This stuff is killing me.
You know, one of the bits that really like fucked me up at Atlas Mountains was carrying, you know, we went to go see Omar in his little
those rocks. Yeah.
Yeah. They walking across those rocks and then carrying the bike up the stairs.
Yeah. I remember that. My experience was different because I was with a group of people that kind of couldn't believe that some mystical like tea shaman was at the end of this like dried riverbed ravine, you know. He kind of lived in like Yoda's hut at the end, and we kind of kept going. There was a dude from Portugal. I believed in him, and we were convinced that like the GPX track was correct. This guy Pierre, who was the partner of my friend Michiel Rockdance, had turned back. He was like, this can't be right. Turned around, and everyone was convinced that that he would have food, which he ultimately didn't necessarily. Right. Other people ended up still going that way and going through this path that you and I are both saying kind of sucked because it was just clobbering over a bunch of rocks. But I hung out at his spot for a long time and like really recharged. That was the night that I rode through the night.
Oh, I remember seeing you the next day.
And yeah, and I passed a ton of people. That was to get to checkpoint 2, I think.
Yeah.
But I was just so recharged from hanging out there for so long. He had coffee, tea. It was radical. And then those stairs didn't bother me as much. Because as soon as you got up the stairs, then you climbed straight up a pretty wide paved road.
Yeah, like it was 20... a big road, wasn't it?
That was surreal to do in the dark because it was like some mammoth scale, like Hot Wheels track, but like reverse. You were just going straight up. Somebody was telling the story, if you heard this, someone saw a car trying to drive up it and it was so steep they had to like keep trying, and then they were going backwards and reverse in the car in like neutral super fast, and they get to the bottom and then try to like go back up it, and it was like really scary for the person trying to climb because you're just inching along at like, you know, 5 or 8 kilometers an hour crawling up this face. So, you know, it's insane.
That first bit of it was really steep as well.
It was insane, but it was paved. Which you were so glad because everything leading up to that had, again, been quite brutal. So yeah. You're like, wow, this is paved, but I'm going straight up a wall.
And then because I descended it as the sun was starting to go down, and then ended up sitting in this little cafe with, like, bumped into Rob sitting in this cafe. And we just sat there and then rode off into the night and then found a nice little riverbed. And then had a nice little snooze, and it reminded me how much Rob snores. It's Rob Quirk.
I think I had camped with him like a night or two before, but frankly, I sleep like a rock, and I didn't notice how much Rob snored. Yeah, but you guys were 2 days before, so it would strike you as more of a theme, something you've experienced before.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I'm with you on the TCR one. It's one I've not done, and it's one that has appealed to me. I've always followed it with interest, and I've never actually gone and bit the bullet and signed up. And a lot of that is because I'd want to do a significant one, and the 10-year thing was something that was also in my mind. So I might see you there, which would be nice. I had signed up to do the Trans-Pyrenees this year, but that was also been cancelled to September next year. That has.
Yeah, we'll see. October. I can't remember. I'd like to do it. The other rule of thumb that a number of people know about when this topic comes up is I feel like I can only justify doing like a big event, like to the scale of like Silk Road or TCR, every other year, because in between I'm doing so many events that it's tough to get away for, you know, 10 days to 2 weeks. But, you know, per the topic earlier in this conversation, there are no events right now. So I don't know what that means. Like, you know, here in the Netherlands there's nothing really until September, and then beyond that no one really knows. So there's no group rides, there's no gravel this or that or anything really, which is quite strange.
What do you think about the whole, like, the Tour de France and all that being moved? I mean, I don't think it's going to happen still.
I also have a pretty, like, well-used or a common, like, canned response for that stuff. Like, a lot of the work that we do does involve pro cycling to some degree. You're super familiar with like Wahoo Fitness, for instance. They've got a number of pro teams using their products and different things, like we work with Silka and they have teams using their products, and we just have like familiarity and involvement with like the pro tour. But also historically I'm like a super bad like sports fan. So I watch some stages, I know a lot of pros personally, and like there's kind of more personal aspects to it. I guess I'm just not like the biggest tour fan. It feels like bad to say that in like a public way. And where I align also with other people Whereas I don't typically jump on these like UCI, like Haterade campaigns or, you know, other aspects of like what could be more inclusive or fair or whatever. It is a chance, just like in so many industries, for them kind of like reevaluate like what we're doing. I think like one of the first criticisms I saw for like the Giro or the Tour or whatever is they were talking about like rescheduling and whatever, but they didn't mention at all anything about the women's races. And it was just kind of like a non like anything. And then everyone's like, well, first of all, we don't really care. We've got bigger fish to fry, guys. And then you're only talking about the dudes. So what's wrong with you? And it's just like more of the same. So I think that's kind of like, you know, get back to the drawing board and like, how do you just do this better? And hopefully that becomes like an opportunity for the people to organize like those events. I think that's probably like my best answer. Like, not getting like back to the same, because I think that's the other kind of easy answer for a lot of people is like, wow, everyone's talking about getting back to normal. Well, for a lot of people, a lot of things that were normal really weren't that good, actually. So
exactly.
Yeah, whether it's bikes or if it's cities or if it's politics or anything, this is a good opportunity to reevaluate stuff. And you see things, and I think a lot of our stuff will be about bikes. I think that's why people are tuning in. But you see, oops, that's my son trying to call. But I sent him a message saying we can call later. You see how quickly cities are taking steps to accommodate bicycles that otherwise, let me just send him a note, that otherwise would have taken months, like tons of bureaucracy, people saying, no, it's not going to work. And like, you know, petitions and people having to sign like online, whatever. And now cities are like, wow, pollution's way down. It's more practical and healthy and for all kinds of reasons within an urban setting to facilitate cycling or walking. So let's make this easier. Let's add some, sorry, I keep getting the phone call.
That's all right.
Let's add bike lanes really quickly. And that happened without any pushback and it just was enacted immediately. So that's an example of in an urban setting where bicycles are being more prioritized that otherwise were just ignored, you know, or at least it took years to do.
Yeah. It's an interesting opportunity to reset, reassess and rejig. That's what I kind of try and think. And I feel that, in all sports that there's something to come out of it that is potentially quite interesting. You know, there's a good opportunity for, you know, people have got time on their hands. So it's a good opportunity to reassess what you're doing, what you love, what you hate, what you enjoy, you know, all those kind of things. What motivates you?
Personal level, yeah. But the disheartening stuff that I read even this morning, and I forget which city it was in China, as they relax some of the restrictions, all of the gridlock is back, all the cars are back, people switch their corona mask for their pollution mask, and it's like back to your regularly scheduled programming. And it's definitely disheartening. So you can see that happen, and it's like the classic adage, like, you know, history repeats itself. So I'm still super idealistic and romantic and you know, positive and hopeful. And we can all kind of assert our own influence in a way. And I think even mentioning it in this kind of setting can help, because it won't really even be our generation. It'll be like my kids' generation that is really faced with this stuff. When it comes to like climate crisis and stuff like that, that really hasn't been a topic, but in a lot of ways, this is kind of a dress rehearsal for that. Like we said at the beginning, like each country and each kind of populace is like addressing things in their own way to different levels of like efficacy against corona. And that's kind of been a slow motion thing with the climate crisis. But this is kind of a premonition or a prequel to when all that goes down, you know, or continues to go down, really. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I find society interesting at the moment, definitely. And the whole climate change thing is something I'm very conscious of, but I feel that as we move into the younger generations, people are becoming more conscious of it, which is good, but it is potentially too late for some of it, definitely. But on the flip side, what's happening with the whole corona thing, and we've seen, it's been proven, unfortunately, as you say, with China going back to their old ways, but it has been proven that these shutdown, lockdown periods have made a massive impact on recovery, you know. So maybe some people might open their eyes up a bit more to it now. I mean, if you want to buy some oil right now, mate, oil is very cheap.
I'm not like the target market, but yeah, I don't know. I think it's just too soon to tell. And a lot of people in a very survivalist kind of way are most concerned with their own family, their own jobs. And like we said at the beginning, you know, staying conscious of like how we can do like icebreaker conversations or reach out to people. My company will be contacting current clients, former clients, and kind of getting an idea of like within the cycling industry, how are people addressing this? What are some of the challenges, even unexpected challenges, or like ways that they're kind of prevailing against setbacks or solutions that they found and stuff, and try to find a way to share that to kind of like improve things. And I don't know how like public ultimately that will be. It's certainly probably in our newsletter. But as a way to kind of make the collective or aggregate response that we can get more actionable and like help people. You know, I've had a few conversations, not in like necessarily a podcast kind of way like this, but with people just to share ideas or their experience or their understanding of what other people are doing. And then that becomes like this flywheel for ideas and other initiatives and kind of getting back to the drawing board of how people can help each other. It comes quite natural for me as the way I like to work already. But it's an opportunity for people to talk to each other and share those things and not everyone kind of stick in a silo and try to, you know, continue the way they were working as like everything isn't working. You know, it can be quite disheartening, you know.
I think it's really, I'm going to plug it for you so you don't have to, but if you don't know Two Tone, follow Two Tone on social media and subscribe to the newsletter, because it's one of the nicest ones that I don't like subscribing to newsletters, and it's a good one.
Thank you, man. Yeah, and thank you. And that is where I really try to make it valuable, and I get responses from people that kind of reinforce that or like kind of convey that I'm accomplishing that with some consistency, that, you know, something was useful or interesting and people reshare it or send me a note. And I think that is what benefits our business. It isn't like a laundry list of stuff that we've done and like, look at this, look what we're doing, because no one really wants to read that. But if I'm sharing things that people can relate to or that they can apply or try on their own or within their own work, that's what makes people want to read it or share it. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's in lots of interesting little stories, and that's one of the things I really like about it. Is it's, you know, newsletters are such a tricky thing. Is sometimes they're like, some, like as you say, quite often it's a look what we've done, and a lot of people are just like, oh, for fuck's sake, I don't care.
But infrequent, I think that's also okay. Like I get those sometimes from brands or agencies or whatever that I admire, and I haven't heard from them in 6 months, and they're like, "Sup guys, we just did this, this, and this, and we're open for new work." And I'm like, whoa, that's really sick. And like, I think it's rad. And then I put it in my newsletter, and then it sends them some traffic, and it is a spotlight on the work they've done. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But my newsletter is every week, which some people are like, holy shit. But then consistently I get upwards of like 40% opens and lots of clicks within the newsletter, and people reshare it and those kinds of things. And then if you're known for sharing something helpful and useful, it's different than every quarter or, you know, twice a year showing kind of your portfolio. It's just a different kind of marketing approach.
Yeah, definitely. It's those ones that, the ones that get me are the ones that are every week, and it is a like a, this is what we've done this week. It's like, and I'm always in those sort of situations, I'm like, I don't work. I'm not your boss. You don't need to tell me what you've done this week, you know. unsubscribe. Yeah. Or the one that made me laugh was the amount of like, this is what we're doing in coronavirus lockdown from companies. And I was like, oh, it's good to know that you have my email on your database, so I know to
remove. That was like a classic. That was a classic failure. I got so many of those. Everyone did. It was like, it was so useless. And I don't know what compelled people to do that, but there's probably something to that, because that was also like an international response, and like and frankly, kind of in the spirit of like what I think is useful, or that I tell people would be helpful for them to try, and for, you know, to try together as far as like sharing information or helping each other, making introductions, those kinds of things. But like telling me what you're doing in your unique situation to like better yourself, it's just a cool story, bro. like what? There's nothing I can take away from that. And then I don't even like use your tool. So like, how'd you get my email? What is this? You know?
So I generally end the podcasts on asking people for 5 tips or life hacks. And Greg's ones, or Gregory's, were brilliant. So you got a tough one to follow.
Oh, man. I'm only imagining it's got like some kind of like crazy Aussie flair about, you know, like surviving in the outback or something, you know, that's really extreme. I don't know.
It was just, we clearly thought about it as well.
Yeah, and you gave me a heads up too. So I'm not unprepared, which I thought was nice of you. Thank you. Because putting me on the spot now would have been equally better and worse, maybe. I have an advantage, I feel, because I have 2 kids and my girlfriend is 4. And you know this if you follow me personally on Instagram. Yeah. So I'm always trying to share some kind of lesson with all the kids that are like running around me, but also like their friends. Because you think how exponentially, you talk about exponential growth. If there's 6 kids and each kid has friends, there's like kids everywhere. So I try to share these tips because I'm often out like riding and skating and hanging out with them also. My first tip, this is like a common thing. It's all these are going to sound very like paternal. So hopefully that's all right. But to take your time and do it right, man. That's like the first one. You know, just take your time and do it right. At the same time, of course, perfection is the enemy of done. So it's like in the kind of software frame of mind, like just ship it. That's one thing. But like, I think people feel like you can growth hack everything and, everything is like you need it now and you're just like rushing and there's typos or it just could have been more refined, or even if you're growing a business or a project or something, like just take your time and do it right. Something you can imagine. You can imagine me saying it to a kid, but people forget this. Like there's no rush, there's no fire. This happens in professional situations too. Like, dude, just take it easy.
I can relate to that one a lot as someone who's dyslexic and has to reread things about 10 times.
Yeah, man, it's okay. Take your time at the end of the day. Just manage expectations. Take your time. Second one, consistency is key. In the same vein where I kind of am critical of this whole like growth hacking mentality, which I think is waning, where like everyone thinks they can slam dunk something or like do something really quick, or, you know, it's like one and done or whatever, moving on to the next thing, or this whole idea of like serial entrepreneurs or whatever. It's like it takes time. You have to do the same thing over time, whether it's like refining a craft, you talk about like craftsmanship or years. I think for people our age, it's sometimes tough to envision, but like staying consistent also, again, can apply to parenthood. If it's like, you know, being consistent with like rules or those kinds of things, but even for being a boss or being an employee, or it could be bike racing, anything, consistency is, I think, it's sometimes forgotten or under prioritized or valued or something, maybe.
Prioritized, definitely.
That was my second one. Third one, just show up. That's a classic one. Like this like Wayne Gretzky thing, like you miss every shot you don't take. When people talk to me about things like Silk Road or Atlas or whatever, they're like, whoa, man, like holy shit, like that's so extreme. I could never. I'm like, yeah, neither could I. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. When I first did Torino Nice Rally, I'd never done anything like that. But I just show up and you just do it. So it's not fake it till you make it. It's just like the people that admire the people that like did the thing they could have at least tried two. Like, you just have to show up. So whether it's a job interview or a bike race or whatever, like, you just have to at least try. You just show up, and then
everyone starts somewhere, don't they?
Yeah, that's the thing. So now people, when they see me as some kind of quasi expert or experienced whatever in some of these things, it's like, yeah, I just showed up to a bunch of them, you know, and that's the hardest part, really, or at least half of the battle. I consulted with my girlfriend Chrissy's youngest son Errol with this when he was eating some ramen noodles earlier, so I changed these around. Attitude is everything. I think that also is quite a cheesy dad thing, but it's particularly applicable now. I think you read a lot of things where people say it's okay to be bummed and sad, you know, to be productive now and all those kinds of things. And I agree. You and I touched on that when we first got on the phone. But this idea of like making lemonade out of lemons, I think that's where the name of this podcast kind of comes from to a degree. Yeah. You have a different spin on it, like zero lemons. So it's kind of a shout even to what you're doing, but it's the perspective that you have. And I think that's what's helped make me more tenacious or positive and maintain that reputation despite the setbacks I've had, like personally or professionally. Like, attitude is everything. Go ahead. What were you gonna say?
I know some of the stuff that's gone on behind the scenes of you, and one of the things that I've always very much admired about you as a person is your positivity and sort of like your attitude of like there's a solution to what's going on. And
yeah, man, that's another classic phrase. Yeah, where there's a will, there's a way. And it's the stuff I say to my kids. And I know by virtue of kind of the audience that I've made for myself, but also the kids that are around watching what I'm doing, like, you know, people say like the Strava rides I do are inspirational. And I'm like, well, thank you. I was just, like I said, I was just stoked to go ride somewhere I've never been. And then people do the same route and they're super excited about it. And that's super cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's just about the perspective that you had or looking on the bright side. And I think people will be hard pressed to disagree with that. So that's my fourth one. Just to keep in mind, attitude is everything. The fifth one, I had to bring it back to bikes because I feel quite strongly about that. And one was more like a maxim or an axiom as opposed to like a life tip of like, bikes will save the world. I think we'll see that with like, you know, kind of cars continue to be phased out in urban areas, at least, or at least car ownership and those kind of things going down and bicycling becoming more viable. At least in my opinion, as far as a life tip or life hack of riding fixes everything. I mean, my professional success, my sanity, all those kind of things go back to bikes. I know not everybody is going to ride a bike. But for me, that's kind of been the glue that's brought everything together that's hard to translate or explain into other things. Yeah. So when I see people getting into cycling, or, you know, like I taught Errol that I just mentioned to ride at all, or I got his older brother Brayden into BMXing, my own two kids, Otto and Mira, into cycling, dozens of other people. I was there when they bought their first bib shorts or whatever. I just hooked up two people with Elements, the Wahoo GPS device that they can do better rides or navigate the rides or whatnot. Enabling people to get into cycling and meeting people through cycling, whatever that is, like riding fixes everything, bikes will save the world. For me, that's the life tip. And I live in Amsterdam and was already bike crazy before I came here, so that's a like spoiler alert, but that's my finale, I think, for the top five.
Mate, that was absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
I always thoroughly enjoy conversations with you.
Thanks, man.
And as I say, I was in a bit of a grump this morning, and that was, normally I'm not grumpy. It's a very rare occasion I am grumpy, and you've shunted me from that mood, which is, I personally thank you for that.
That's right.
Yeah, I was proper grump. I don't even know why. I just woke up in a bad mood, which happens, you know, that's life.
It does happen, man. And like, it's like Groundhog Day for everybody right now. So yeah, like I said, it's okay. But, you know, being aware of your mentality or your perspective, you know, or doing what you have to do to change it, whether it's writing or hosting a podcast.
Yeah, talking with rad people.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Cool. So I'm gonna end it there, wrap up there. You have been John. If you want to follow John or anything, like, get involved with Two Tone Amsterdam. They're really, really cool. I'm a huge fan, as I say, of the newsletter. Get subscribed. Just listen to the kind of fun stuff that John gets up to with his gang. And yeah, I'm going to wrap it there. Thanks so much, mate.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yep.
Cheers.
Thanks.